an agreement that only points toward gradual shifting of energy systems, of deforestation rates, of transportation, of everything else that contributes to climate change. Only a gradual shift is not going to do it.
My name is Ronnie Jumo. I'm Seychelles' roving ambassador, or ambassador at large, for climate change and small island developing state issues. And in the absence of my president and the ministers, I'm the head of delegation for the Seychelles delegation to COP21.
In my youth, I actually did quite a bit of research and work in Samoa, and fell in love with a beautiful island which had the most beautiful singing I have ever heard. And that contrasts quite remarkably with the Samoa that I saw last year. A Samoa that is still a beautiful island, but that is in serious threat.
Night has fallen, and the COP venue is calm for the moment. Skepticism continues to grow, and the numbers make clear why. The current text still has 1,585 square brackets and issues to be resolved. There are 9 days left. In the main plenary hall, everybody keeps talking about ambition. But especially in the case of Australia, such words can serve to disguise a negotiating team's actual motives.
Together, we have generated a text that holds within it the opportunity to conclude an ambitious and credible Paris Agreement that can establish a strategy to keep global temperature rise below 2 degrees. Let us be clear. We need ambition and clarity here and now.
My name is Peter Woodcott, and I'm the Australian Ambassador for the Environment. We have a team of something like 30 negotiators here. We are a major mining nation. We've always been a major exporter of coal. I think we're the second largest exporter of coal in the world. If we were to stop exporting coal in Australia, that would not make, in our view, any difference to the state of emissions in the world. It may even exacerbate them because Australian coal is high quality. And our Prime Minister has said, if we stopped exporting coal, it doesn't mean coal isn't going to be used. Coal is still used extensively in, particularly in our part of the world and in Africa. Still, coal remains the cheapest, in those parts of the world, the cheapest source of energy and power, and that means the fastest way towards economic development and growth for them. But coal is a very complex issue. You can't be too simplistic about coal.
Up to now, hundreds of security officers have managed to successfully monitor the 2 kilometer wide area for threats. But suddenly, some of them start looking very nervous.
Last night, Australia's Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, spoke at a side event hosted by Indonesia, where she said coal will remain critical to promoting prosperity, growing economies, and alleviating hunger for years to come. You're welcome, poor people. Here you go, have some coal. Hand out some coal to these poor people. Yes, delicious coal. Yummy, delicious coal. Oh, man. Oh, eat it. Eat it. Eat it. Eat that coal. Yet the Australian government still supports the construction of the largest coal mine in the southern hemisphere, right on the edge of the Great Barrier Reef. In Australia, we love big things.
Salim tells us that behind closed doors, the small island states are fighting for the survival of their nations. There are about 30 countries that will cease to exist if we don't reach the 1.5 degree temperature target. The press and the public are barred from entering this meeting, but we managed to sneak into the secret talks with a hidden camera.
On 1.5, for small island states, holding the increase in temperature rise to below 1.5 degrees is a matter of survival. As it is for so many countries in this room, Mr. President, Would it have been better for all of us, for future generations, to have text that expresses the urgency of actions to hold temperature rise to below 1.5 degrees? Absolutely.
We wish we can be as optimistic as our co-chairs who were heading the ambition group. I really think we need to have much more discussions with regard to Article 2, Paragraph 1A. I don't think we really do have consensus there. Or in Article 3.1, we are really far away from consensus, Mr. President, and I think we really need to have much more discussions.
We small island developing states, we see it every day. Some of us, we are so small that we hear the wind blow from the east across to the west. Some of us are so small that when rain comes, we get frightened and we anticipate that danger could lie ahead for us. The day-to-day evidence of ordinary citizens that live in small island developing states cannot be denied. The fact is, sir, that we know because we watch our beaches disappear, we watch our homes washed away, we watch our dreams washed away, and we certainly do not want to watch our lives washed away.
The dramatic pleas of the island states are shocking to us. Within the next 10 to 20 years, the first of them will already have disappeared.
While we have been here, we have seen a repeat of the pattern of more floods and landslides. Indeed, today in Chennai, these events continue. This video was taken from just a few days ago, and the people of Tamil Nadu are suffering the consequences of this continuing downpour. Today, England has experienced the largest downpour in the entire history. Many people had to be rescued there. These events, may I reiterate, are taking place while we are here. Every day in the world, these events are occurring in places all around the earth. Super Typhoon Haiyan was the strongest ocean-based storm at its time to ever make landfall. And of course, our hearts went out to the people of Tacloban.
Haiyan, that year, was the 21st typhoon to hit Philippines. They got the warnings, they went to the shelters, they died in the shelters collapsed. So Haiyan was not a normal typhoon, it was a super typhoon. Haiyan hit the Philippines the day before the Warsaw COP. And Yap Sano, the chief Philippines negotiator, made a statement, a very emotional statement.
I see Philippines asking for the floor, so please.
The initial assessment showed that Haiyan left a wake of massive destruction that is unprecedented, unthinkable. Mr. President, I speak for my delegation, but I speak for the countless people who will no longer be able to speak for themselves. Now, Mr. President, if you will allow me, Super Typhoon Haiyan made landfall in my own family's hometown. And the devastation is staggering. I struggle to find words even for the images that we see on the news coverage. And I struggle to find words to describe how I feel about the losses in solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home. I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate. This means I will voluntarily refrain from eating food during this COP until a meaningful outcome is in sight. Mr. President, what my country is going through is madness. Mr. President, we can stop this madness right here in Warsaw.
that he's going on a fast, that he's going to not eat for the next 2 weeks. Many of us fasted with him. That's how we got the Warsaw International Mechanism in the COP. You know, for 19 years, the rich countries prevented us from talking about loss and damage. But we managed to get it done because we were united till the very end. We said we will not agree to anything in Warsaw. We go home, Warsaw is a failure, unless you give us this. And in the end, they blinked. They gave it to us. It's the only time we've got something out of them.
Outside the COP venue, we're lucky to run into Yeb Sanyo, the former lead negotiator of the Philippines at the COP in Warsaw.
After Warsaw, without me knowing the full reason behind it, I was taken out of the Philippine delegation. So it's not as if I walked away from the process. I was taken out. And if I was taken out because I have been vocal about rich nations having to take responsibility and about the fossil fuel industry being the biggest problem that stands in the way, that should give me a lot of pride to be taken out. Because climate change is a battle that will not be won or lost in the conference halls here.
As the powerful groups in the negotiations work to undermine the 1.5 degree goal of the poor and vulnerable countries, Salim is fighting behind the scenes for his allies. In this, he has some influential backers.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm here in my capacity as the chair of the Independent Expert Advisory Group to the Climate Vulnerable Forum. It's now my pleasure to invite Cristiana Figueres, the Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention.
Cristiana.
Thank you very much, my good friend Salimul, and Honorable President Aquino, distinguished ministers. May I raise a voice of concern? I do not see the countries working in an articulated and coordinated fashion for this Paris Agreement. This is an urgent matter, but it is the countries around this table and many others outside that are going to determine whether we have an ambitious agreement or whether we just have an agreement. The danger is not to aim too high and fail. The danger is to aim too low and only do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cristiana.
It was agreed that all countries would now take action. And so the idea of the INDC, the intended nationally determined contributions, came up. And every country started developing their own. The problem with this voluntary action is that when you add it up, it's not enough. Collectively, it doesn't take us to 2 degrees. It takes us to maybe just under 3 degrees. And so if we want to go to 1.5 degrees, then we have to ramp it up. Every country has to do much more than they promised.
The national contributions don't even come close to saving us from environmental collapse.
Now, Your Excellency, the goal has to be durable. Making specific references, which we have on the table now, options for specific numbers, may not make it a durable agreement. Any goal that threatens our ability to eradicate poverty, any goal that threatens our ability to secure food, is not going to be accepted. And there are one of the options, at least here, that option can be a threat to sustainable development, poverty eradication, and food production.
Monsieur le Président, the draft agreement text is shorter, but we need a bolder text with fewer undecided options, including on key issues. Mr. President, while the basis for an ambitious landing zone is still in this text, many options cross our red lines. Some options have even been lost altogether. We must raise the level of ambition. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us. The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We were talking about Al-Amr Bil-Ma'ruf Wa Nahi An Al-Munkar. We were talking about the reward. We were talking about all the positive things that would lead to the betterment of a society. And that's exactly what we mean when we do talk about having a correct social system as far as the Islamic approach is concerned. Then we ended off with just one hadith about what would be the dangers of abandoning this wajib duty of ours, this obligatory responsibility that we have as far as Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi an al-Munkar. What's going to happen if we put this aside? You know, will we become like today's modern world where no one cares about nobody else anymore? It's very, very rare where we find someone who really, really wants to, you know, be there and assist someone. And because we're so much in our own bubbles and we're in this individualized society, we might not have that eager interest in wanting to establish righteousness in our communities. And so that's why I'd just like to share some interesting ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that warn us about what the dangers will be of us abandoning our duty of al-amr bil ma'ruf wa nahi 'an al-munkar. The previous hadith we had mentioned was God is going to take away your barakah, God's going to take away your blessings. Another hadith says that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi says that if you don't do it, فَإِن لَمْ تَفْعَلُوا ذَٰلِكَ وَصُلِّطَ بَعْضُكُمْ بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُمْ نَاصُرٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فِي السَّمَاءِ, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will, you know, replace those who are righteous in ruling over you to those who are evil and wicked to rule over you.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
From Imam Al-Kadhim Salamullahi Alayhi, he says, وَلَتَأْمُرُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَلَتَنْهُنَّ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. You should, you must do your Amr bil Ma'ruf and your Nahi anil Munkar. Or أو ليستعملن الله عليكم شراركم فتدعوا خياركم فلا يستجاب لكم. Or else, if you don't do your amr bil ma'roof, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he says, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will place over you the evil among you. So the evil among you will rule and reside and govern and be authority over you. فَتَدْعُوا خِيَارَكُمْ. And the best, the noble among you, the righteous among you, will do dua, will pray, will ask God to relieve you of these problems and these issues. فَلَا يُسْتَجَابْ لَهُمْ. And their dua, the dua of the righteous, will not be accepted. Why? Because you abandoned al-amr bil-ma'roof and nahi an al-munkar. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that someone who doesn't do amr bil ma'roof and anahi an al munkar, even in their whatever level of amr bil ma'roof wa nahi an al munkar, then they're like a dead person. من ترك إنكار المنكر بقلبه ويده ولسانه. Someone who stops doing nahi an al munkar, who stops forbidding the wrong, either by their hand or by their tongue or by their heart, then فَهُوَ مَيِّتُ الْأَحْيَاء. Then he or she is like a dead person among the living. Very interesting hadith this is actually. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, إِذَا رَأَى الْمُنْكَرِ. If someone sees something wrong happening, فَلَمْ يُنْكِرْهُ. And you don't show your discontent, you don't, you know, condemn it, if we could say. وَهُوَ يَقْدِرُ عَلَيْهِ. And you're able to do something about stopping it. You're able to do something about rejecting it. You're able to condemn it in whatever way possible. وَمَنْ أَحَبَّ يُعْصَى اللَّهِ فَقَدْ بَارَزَ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ بِالْعَدَاوَةِ. That means that you like God being sinned. And if you like God being sinned, it is like you are combating your hostility towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
I invite you to listen to the continuation of the program on IRIB English Radio.
There are many, many other ahadith that speak about the dangers of abandoning your duty of al-amr bil-ma'roof wal-nahi an al-munkar. I do encourage my dear brothers and sisters to look into this topic, to further development, and find ways of you yourself being able to apply al-amr bil-ma'roof wal-nahi an al-munkar in a positive way, in an encouraging way, in a way that would bring interest among people, that would, you know, attract people to doing good and to staying away from bad and evil. Another very important issue that we deal with is deviancy. People who introduce wrong ideologies, people who introduce wrong and bad and haram habits, individuals who might somehow want to infiltrate into the ranks of the believers and introduce something that would not only bring about misconceptions but destabilize a person's faith. These kind of individuals, they need to be dealt with, and dealt with swiftly. Ahlul bid'ah, as they say. We'll continue on with this topic in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A spat over COVID has exposed friction between former President Donald Trump and a rising GOP governor, Ron DeSantis, who is unwilling to curb his ambitions. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Jonathan Martin, Maggie Haberman, and Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, "Who is King of Florida? Tensions Rise Between Trump and a Former Acolyte." Stay with us for more. For months, former President Donald Trump has been grumbling quietly to friends and visitors to his Palm Beach mansion about a rival Republican power center in another Florida mansion, some 400 miles to the north. Governor Ron DeSantis, a man that Donald Trump believes he put on the map, has been acting far less like an acolyte and more like a future competitor, Mr. Trump complains. With his stock rising fast in the Republican Party, the governor has conspicuously refrained from saying he would stand aside if Donald Trump runs for the Republican nomination for president in 2024. The magic words Trump has said to several associates and advisors. That long stewing resentment burst into public view recently in a dispute over a seemingly unrelated topic, COVID policies. After Ron DeSantis refused to reveal his full COVID vaccination history, the former president publicly acknowledged he had received a booster shot. Last week, he seemed to swipe at Ron DeSantis by blasting as gutless politicians who dodged the question out of fear of blowback from vaccine skeptics. Mr. DeSantis shot back on Friday, 14th of January, criticizing Donald Trump's early handling of the pandemic and saying he regretted not being more vocal in his complaints. The back and forth exposed how far Republicans have shifted to the right on coronavirus politics. The doubts Donald Trump amplified about public health expertise have only spiraled since he left office. Now his defense of the vaccines, even if often subdued and almost always with the caveat in the same breath that he opposes vaccine mandates, has put him uncharacteristically out of step with the hardline elements of his party's base and provided an opening for a rival. But that it was Mr. DeSantis, a once loyal member of the Trump court, wielding the knife made the tension about much more. The dispute amounts to a stand-in for the broader challenge confronting Republicans at the outset of midterm elections. They are led by a defeated former president who demands total fealty, brooks no criticism, and is determined to sniff out and then snuff out any threat to his control of the Republican Party. That includes the 43-year-old Ron DeSantis, who has told friends he believes Donald Trump's expectation that he bend the knee is asking too much. That refusal has set up a generational clash and a test of loyalty in the de facto capital of today's GOP, one watched by Republicans elsewhere who've ridden to power on Mr. Trump's coattails. Already, party figures are attempting to calm matters. They're the two most important leaders in the Republican Party, said Brian Ballard, a longtime Florida lobbyist with connections to both men, predicting Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis will be personal and political friends for the rest of their careers. Donald Trump's aides also have tried to tamp down questions about the former president's frustrations so as not to elevate Mr. DeSantis. Still, Mr. Trump has made no secret of his preparations for a third run for a White House. And while Ron DeSantis, who's up for re-election this year, has not declared his plans, he is widely believed to be eyeing the presidency. Donald Trump and his aides are mindful of Republicans' increasingly public fatigue with the drama that trails Mr. Trump. The former president's false claims about fraud in the 2020 presidential election, which Ron DeSantis has not challenged, and his role in the events leading to the 6th of January riot at the Capitol have some Republicans looking for a fresh start. Governor Ron DeSantis is often the first name Republicans cite as a possible Trump-style contender not named Trump. DeSantis would be a formidable 2024 candidate in the Trump lane should Donald Trump not run, said Dan Eberhardt, a Republican donor. Eberhardt added, he's Trump but a little smarter, more disciplined and brusque without being too brusque. Notably, Mr. Trump, a longtime student of charisma and mass appeal, as well as an avid reader of polling, has refrained so far from publicly attacking Ron DeSantis, who is a distant but potent second to him in opinion polls on the 2024 GOP field. His restraint is a break from the mockery and bullying he often uses to attack Republicans that he perceives as vulnerable. Donald Trump made no reference to the Governor DeSantis at a rally in Arizona on Saturday, 15th of January. Mr. DeSantis has $70 million in the bank for his re-election, a war chest he stocked with the help from the Republican rank and file and donor class alike. He has raised his profile in the same spaces that Mr. Trump once dominated. The governor is ubiquitous on Fox News Channel, where he is routinely met with the sort of softballs that once arced towards Mr. Trump. And he frequently mixes with the well-tanned Republican donor community near the former president's winter home in South Florida. But it was not always this way. Ron DeSantis was a little-known Florida congressman back in 2017 when Donald Trump, who was then the president, spotted him on television and took keen interest in him. Mr. DeSantis, an Ivy League-educated military veteran and smooth-talking defender of the new president, was exactly what Donald Trump liked in a politician. It wasn't long before Donald Trump blessed Ron DeSantis's bid for governor and sent in staff to help him, lifting the lawmaker to a victory over a better-known rival for the party's nomination. Ron DeSantis survived the general election and has often governed in a style that mirrors his patron, slashing at the left and scrapping with the news media. But that alone doesn't placate Donald Trump. As with other Republicans he has endorsed, the former president appears to take a kind of ownership interest in Mr. DeSantis and to believe that he's owed dividends and deference. Look, I help Ron DeSantis at a level that nobody's ever been before, Donald Trump said in an interview for a forthcoming book, Insurgency, on the rightward shift of the Republican Party by the New York Times reporter Jeremy Peters. Donald Trump said he believed Mr. DeSantis didn't have a chance of winning without his help. The former president's expectation of deference from Mr. DeSantis is a reminder to other Republicans that a Trump endorsement comes with a price. A demand that could prove particularly consequential should he run again and have a stable of Republican lawmakers in his debt. At times, Donald Trump has sought to kindle his relationship with Ron DeSantis. he has suggested the governor would be a strong choice for vice president. Similar courtship has helped win deference from other potential rivals, but Mr. DeSantis has not relented. "I wonder why the guy won't say he won't run against me," Donald Trump has said to several associates and advisers who spoke on condition of anonymity to describe private conversations. Mr. Trump began the recent contretemps for attacking the governor's refusal to acknowledge whether he had received the COVID-19 booster shot. "The answer is yes, but they don't want to say it because they're gutless," Donald Trump said in a television interview this month, referring only to politicians but clearly alluding to Ron DeSantis. "You've got to say it, whether you had it or not. Say it." Mr. DeSantis' response came on Friday, 14th of January, in an interview on the conservative podcast Ruthless. Speaking in front of an in-person audience near St. Petersburg, Florida, the governor said one of his biggest regrets was not forcefully opposing Donald Trump's calls for lockdowns when the coronavirus first began to spread in the spring of 2020. "Knowing now what I know then, if that was a threat earlier, I would have been much louder," Mr. DeSantis said. The governor said he had been telling Trump stop the flights from China, but argued he never thought in early March of 2020 that the coronavirus would lead to locking down the country. Mr. DeSantis then moved quickly to placate blame on Dr. Anthony Fauci, who advised Donald Trump on the country's COVID response, a much safer target with conservatives. The former president did not immediately respond. Without a Twitter account, his hair-trigger retorts have become much less frequent. A spokesman for Donald Trump also did not respond to requests for comment. An advisor to Ron DeSantis also declined to comment.
This is the sentence of Izotso. He's saying that the only thing that I can say is that I feel that as if I am enchanted by Islam.
Besides this, he has a book that is talking about God and human being in the Holy Quran. And some other books that the subject of them are Quranic, you know, concepts and Quranic issues.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
We've wronged ourselves. What will we say in front of it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm your host, Ata. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Mahdavi and Shaykh Ziyaniya. Shaykh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Shaykh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So in the new series of the program, The Teacher, we are mainly concerned with the scholars, the ulama, the jurists, those researchers who are interested in Islamic studies. Most of them are Muslims and the Shia Muslims. Some of them are not Muslims. You know, there are among the non-Muslims who showed interest and dedication to Islamic studies and research on Islamic history. And The Teacher is mainly concerned with introducing such dignitaries and scholars all across the world of Islam. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of those non-Muslim, it's better to say, researchers on the text of the Holy Quran, whose name is Toshihiko Izotso, the linguist, philosopher, and a researcher of the Holy Quran, originally from Japan, who was born in 1914 in Tokyo. So, Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life and the background of Toshihiko Izotso.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Professor Toshihiko Izotso was born in 4th day of May in 1914 in Tokyo, Japan, and he was professor in Islamic studies plus Arabic language and in philosophy and also in Eastern religions. He was born in a wealthy family and his father was a wealthy man. And beside being wealthy, his father was strict Buddhist.
Okay.
So he was trying to, you know, bring up his son, a person who is firm Buddhist and as a person who, you know, believes in Buddhism deep in his heart. So because of that, Izotso was tolerating and suffering from some sort of asceticism during his young age.
Okay.
And because of this, he was not, you know, that much satisfied with Buddhism.
Okay.
That's why he decides to study about different religions in his young age. And beside that, he didn't like, you know, studying economic. He started studying economic.
Yes.
But after all, he changed his major and started learning Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's famous that he learned about 30 languages, from which he was fluent in at least 17 languages. He was understanding and writing and reading in these languages, amongst which was Persian, was Arabic, was many different languages, English. So Izotso dedicated his life in studying language, and beside that, he was interested in different religions and philosophy. That's why he moved to Montreal and taught there. And in Montreal, he got familiar with Professor Muhaqqiq, a person who made Izotso familiar with Iran. And from that moment on, Izotso had many travels to Iran. After all, he even stayed about 7 years, 6 years in Iran.
Okay.
And he left Iran in 1978. I want to add a point here that you mentioned Izotso was not a Muslim. It's famous that he was not a Muslim.
Yes.
But the director of a documentary about Izotso that is made in Iran, the name is The Eastern.
Yes.
The director says that it's famous that Izotso was not a Muslim, but I do believe that according to the documents that he has collected during, the work that he had done, he believes that Izotso was converted into Islam and was a Muslim.
As Sheikh Ziya mentioned, you know, most of his researchers were regarding Islamic studies, especially Islamic philosophy, Islamic hikmah, and Islamic mysticism. Of course, the people who come from Japan, originally somehow in their sectarian beliefs, have such trainings. I mean, mystical, ascetic, we can say, teachings in the Eastern traditions. And that's why they believe in such a spiritual trainings and movements, and nowadays we can find it too. But what made Izotso interested in Islamic philosophy, Irfan, and hikmah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very nice question. Why I'm saying that this is a very nice question? Because as you mentioned, this is something typical that most of the time when we look at the history of the people who are coming from the East because of the environment they grow in, they have this tendency upon Irfan, asceticism, mysticism, things which has something to do with the spiritual aspect of the life.
Yes.
This is something which is typical. But what made the scholar like Izotso to be interested in Islamic version of spirituality? That's why this is a nice question to know about it.
Yes.
So I think this is good to ask this question from the very person, Izotso.
Okay.
And he was asked this question.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because he had produced a lot of works in terms of Islamic philosophy, Islamic mysticism. So this is very strange. What made you to get interested in Islam? Because we have different versions of spirituality here and there in the West or East.
Yes.
But what made you to get interested in Islamic version of it? And in response, he says that, "I can't say anything. And my interest upon Islamic philosophy and Islamic mysticism is a kind of mysterious interest. Even within myself, I cannot understand why I am interested. The only thing that I can say, this is the sentence of Izotso.
Okay.
He's saying that the only thing that I can say is that I feel that as if I am enchanted by Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this could be considered as a complementary point, or we may say supplementary point, for what our brother Sheikh Diyaniya mentioned, that the director of that documentary believes that he had converted. We don't know what happened in reality, but this is something which is quoted from Izotso, and I think it helps us a lot in this regard.
This documentary is called Sharqi in Farsi, which roughly can be translated from East or Eastern, you know. It was directed and produced and written by Masoud Tahiri. It is about the life of Izotso. But Sheikh Ziyaniya, one of the other main interests of Izotso was the Holy Quran. What details can you give us about his research methodology about the Holy Quran?
Okay, you know, because Quran is the main text in the religion of Islam, that's why every person who wants to work on Islamic studies automatically is pushed toward the Holy Quran. So Izotso was not an exception regarding this. And he started translating the Holy Quran from Arabic into Japanese. And that was the first time that this process was done by a Japanese person. Of course, he was not the last. We talked that previously that Professor Sawada also translated Quran from Arabic into Japanese. But Izotso is the first person who tries this.
Yes.
And he translated the Holy Quran in 3 volumes into Japanese. And he had some theories regarding this, of course, because it's a technical discussion, so I do not want go into the details. But he has a theory regarding the translation of the Quran. He has some books regarding this. He has a theory regarding the semantic of the words of the Holy Quran, how to translate them, how to, you know, get closer to the concepts of the words. Of course, he do believes that some of the words in every language, as he says this, that some of the words in every language are not translatable.
Mm-hmm.
You are not able to translate these words.
Yes.
But he gives some ways to get closer to the concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Besides this, he has a book that is talking about God and human being in the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And some other books that the subject of them are Quranic, you know, concepts and Quranic issues. That shows that he was maybe absorbed by the teachings of the Holy Quran. And he dedicated at least some years of his life.
That's
and
right.
Let me say the ending part of his life for researching and writing and working about Islamic studies. And it's interesting that when he returns from Iran to Japan in 1978, he tries to work and write his books in Japanese, not in English.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that I want to transfer these teachings into Japanese language because I do believe that these, you know, ideas are needed in Japanese language.
Mm-hmm.
So he does not writing his books
in English.
English.
That's right.
On that part of his life. Before that, he had some works in English, but at the ending part of his life, he tries to write the books in Japanese. And we should know that the ending moments of his life was like this, that he fell down in his house.
Mm-hmm.
He got a strike and he thought that it's not something serious.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was a brain bleeding, but he was not aware of that. That's why he told his wife that I'm going to have some sleep and rest.
Okay.
And he slept and never woke up again in this world. But we ask Almighty God to send blessings to his soul, because he dedicated much of his time regarding Quran and Islamic studies.
Sure.
And he is valuable in this regard and noticeable.
That's right. The point that you mentioned about leaving this legacy in their own mother languages about Islam is really important. The program, the teacher is also interested in finding the people who have left different works on different fields of studies regarding the religion of Islam in their own mother tongues, you know, whether it be Japanese, you know, we can't say the African ones or any type of language. Okay, Sheikh Matavi, any point missed? We got a final moments of our program for today's discussion.
Actually, I think this is good to appreciate the role of people whom Izotso met in his life.
Okay.
If we look at the works of Izotso, we can say that he received a good influence from the works or from the discussions that he had with the contemporary scholars.
Yes.
Henry Corbin, Said Hossein Nas, there are people whom he met and they had a discussion together. So these meetings, which brings people and scholars from East and the West, and they sit around one table and discuss about Islamic issues with different backgrounds, and we see the fruits.
Yes.
So this is something that we have to appreciate.
Yeah, the dialogue between different people from different religions. That's the real picture that the believing people around the world are looking for. I mean, interfaith and intrafaith dialogue and unity between all the believers with respect. And, you know, this can be found in the scholars. And unfortunately, in the recent years, we could see that the picture that is shown out of the religion of Islam in the Western media is converse and vice versa. It is a barbaric, violent, you know, picture of Islam. But the beautiful side of Islam is these scholarly discussions, you know, among the Muslims and non-Muslims regarding the Holy Quran and the history of Islam. And I think this beautiful aspect is really fascinating. And I invite all non-Muslims to read about Islam and do more research about Islam. January 7th, 1993, Toshihiko Izotso passed away in Japan. May Allah bless his soul. One of the, we can say, people who dedicated his life on research in Islamic mysticism, hikmah, philosophy, and also the text of the Holy Quran. Thank you, Omar Sheikh Mahdavi.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziya Inia.
You're most welcome.
For your presence in the program, The Teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say until then?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.